Good day. Today is Thursday, 12th February 2026, and the situation connected to the Middle East is intensifying, and there are more reports now, increasing numbers of reports, that the Russians and the Chinese are becoming more deeply involved in the crisis. It's very difficult, all but impossible, to distinguish fact from rumour, because both the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians are being very, very quiet about what is happening. And it's very difficult to say exactly what is the case. But let me repeat again that just a few days ago, I got a report, a private report from Russia, or at least from somebody who has contacts in Russia, the same person who regularly provides me with what have proved to be consistently accurate information about discussions that take place within the Russian parliament, the Duma. Anyway, this informant told me that the Russians have indeed been taking various steps over the last few weeks in anticipation of potential military action by the United States. Specifically, the Russians have been providing Iran with increasing amounts of intelligence data. They have actually moved a contingent of forces, around 5,000 troops, closer to Iranian territory. And they have also provided the Iranians, definitely, as we know, with helicopter gunships, Mi-28s. These have been seen, and there are photographs of them, but also apparently with other information as well, from satellites, from other things. And the latest information, which does not come from this source, by the way, but which has been widely provided, and which I believe may be true, is that the Russians have now started to provide Iran with advanced electronic jammers, presumably intended to deflect American long-range missiles, the kind of long-range missiles that are likely to be used by the United States in the event that there is a strike against Iran. So this activity does seem to be taking place. As I said, it's very difficult to distinguish real information from rumour, but this information does this time seem to be more reliable than information I remember receiving in the summer of 2024 about the placement of Russian air defence missile systems in Iran, S-400s and S-300s. Those reports turned out to be untrue and they were extremely vague. But anyway, regardless, it does seem as if this time some of these reports are true. And I say this on the strength of the fact that I'm getting this information, as I said, from people with access to information inside Russia. I also understand that the Americans and the Russians are now in almost constant contact about the situation in the Middle East and relating to Iran, and that discussions between the Russians, the Americans in particular, and by the way, the Russians and the Israelis are also regularly, almost continuously, underway. Lastly, I would go back to that visit by Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, to Russia, which took place about a week ago. Larijani, as we know, met with Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. We've never been provided by the Russians with any full explanation of what Larijani and Putin discussed. But it seems that Larijani didn't just meet other Russian officials as I believed, but that same source that I spoke about a moment ago, the one who tells me about Russian assistance to Iran, the fact that the Russians have deployed a contingent of troops closer to the Iranian border. I believe, by the way, these are air defense troops, just to make that clear. This source has informed me that Larijani also met with Chinese officials, Chinese military and security officials at the Chinese embassy in Moscow. And, well, as a number of people, Eve Smith at Naked Capitalism have been pointing out, China has been recently publishing very, very accurate and very interesting photographs of American military bases in the Middle East, which it has obtained from its satellites. And Eve Smith points out that the mere act of publication of these photos, in a sense, also is a way of China providing quite openly and publicly Iran with targeting data, just to say. But beyond that, I suspect that the publication of these photos from the Chinese satellites is also a warning by China to the United States. They are telling the Americans, look, we know where your bases are. You can't know for a fact that we are providing all this information to the Iranians, but perhaps we are, perhaps we're not. It's part of the war of nerves, the guessing game that continues to happen all the time. Now, there have been other reports. There have been reports that the Russians have provided Iskander missiles to Iran. I discussed this in an earlier program. I've seen no evidence that this is the case. And again, it might be that what is being confused here is information about the Iskander missile, with Iranian missiles, of which, of course, Iran has an abundance. But again, now I come back to the information I got from the source. The source tells me that one of the things that the Russians have been doing in their contacts with the Iranians is that they have helped the Iranians to increase the accuracy of their missiles. That could take many forms. It could be, of course, providing the Iranians with targeting data. And by the way, about a week ago, Russia launched a Soyuz rocket from one of its cosmodromes, which released a large number of satellites, all of which are operating apparently for the Russian Defense Ministry. Some people assumed that this was connected to the Starlink disconnection in Ukraine, but obviously launching of rockets with satellites is something that is prepared over many months. And I think it is more likely that these are surveillance satellites. And though it's unlikely that this launch was done precisely in light of the current moves in the Middle East, it is likely that this launch has provided the Kremlin with further eyes in the sky which it can use to monitor and observe what the American fleets that are gathering close to Iran are doing. And of course, that satellite data could combine with any updates that the Russians are helping to provide to the Iranians for their missiles. And that might make the missiles significantly more accurate, perhaps, and better capable of evading American defences than has been true up to this time. Now, to repeat again, this information comes from a source who has been consistently reliable and who indisputably does have sources of information from Russia, as he has demonstrated many times. So I assume that the United States is aware itself of much and perhaps all of this, and this may be affecting its calculations, because there has been apparently hesitation by the United States. There were reports about a week ago that the United States was on the brink of conducting an attack on Iran. Last week, I mentioned that there was reports that there was a very high possibility that the attack on Iran might take place over the past weekend. It didn't do so. And it could be that the United States, the Pentagon, is also aware and alert to these latest Russian moves, and that this is causing concerns. And by the way, when I say Russian moves, I am more informed about what the Russians are doing, but it's highly likely that the Chinese, who are also involved and who have close relations with Iran, are taking steps of their own. We'll come to all of that in a moment. I would just, however, add that there is one thing that the Russians have actually done indirectly, which has had a massive bearing on the configuration of forces in the Middle East and indeed everywhere else in the world. I go back to those articles that I discussed in my program yesterday, the articles by Eli Lake and by Jennifer Kavanagh in Responsible Statecraft, about how the cupboard of air defense missiles in the United States is bare. Perhaps I should be more precise and say that the cupboard of Patriot air defense missiles appears to be bare. US Navy ships, the Arleigh Burke class destroyers, do not carry Patriot missiles. They carry standard missiles as part of the Aegis system. But I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that production of Aegis air defense missiles is running significantly below that of Patriot missiles. There is only a limited number of these missiles that any Arleigh Burke type destroyer can carry. And of course, it must share the space for air defense missiles with Tomahawk cruise missiles that apparently are launched from the same launcher, and which the United States presumably intends to use in the event that there is indeed an attack on Iran. So anyway, returning to this topic, clearly the heavy use by Ukraine of Patriot air defense missile interceptors is not going to drain standard class air defense missiles for US Arleigh Burke destroyers. We're talking about different missiles, which presumably are produced on different production lines. I'm not an expert on this, but I presume that that is the case. However, Patriot missiles, which are produced in much bigger quantities, or so I understand, by the United States than standard missiles, are the air defense missiles that are required to defend US facilities across the Middle East, including Israel, in Israel itself. So if there is a shortage of air defense missiles, that affects the ability of the United States to defend its own bases and installations across the Middle East. And, well, coming back to the standard class missiles on the destroyers, there's only a finite number of those, as others, Larry Johnson at Sonar 21, for example, have pointed out. given the limited number of launches for standard missiles on the Ali Burke destroyers in the Arabian Sea, and given that there is almost certainly a relatively small number of these missiles on these destroyers anyway, an American force that engages Iran is going to be extremely short of air defense missiles. All of this at the same time that the Russians apparently are working with the Iranians in order to improve Iranian capabilities. Now, that may explain a number of decisions that appear to have been made by the United States over the last couple of days and hours. Firstly, some days ago, President Trump said that he was considering deploying a second aircraft carrier and task force to the Arabian Sea. And there are reports that a preparation order for such a aircraft carrier to join the Abraham Lincoln, the USS Abraham Lincoln, and its task force in the Arabian Sea has now been given. Though, as again Larry Johnson points out in Sonar 21, that preparation order is not identical to a deployment order, and we might still be some time away from that decision. Anyway, so it looks as if the Americans are thinking of sending another carrier task force to the Arabian Sea. And obviously, that will increase their offensive firepower against Iran. It will increase it considerably. But perhaps more importantly, given the shortage of air defense missiles and given the specific critical situation with Patriot air defense missiles, the aircraft carrier, the second aircraft carrier, will come with more destroyers, and presumably that will thicken out, at least to some extent, the deployed force of standard missiles that will be there to protect the American ships. Anyway, this is an ominous development, but it's an interesting one, and it suggests that the Americans have assessed the balance of forces in Iran and are beginning to wonder whether they have enough forces and how much offensive and defensive power they actually need to deploy. That this war, in other words, is going to be more difficult and more complex than they perhaps had initially expected. Now, the other thing that suggests that the Americans are starting to have some doubts is a meeting that took place yesterday between the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and the President of the United States, Donald Trump. Now, the first thing to say is that there's been much discussion and speculation about this meeting, and it is widely believed that Netanyahu's purpose in coming to this meeting was to try to persuade Trump to insist on the absolute maximalist terms that the United States has made to Iran, to insist that Iran must give up its entire nuclear enrichment capability, that it must cap the range of its ballistic missiles and perhaps dismantle many of them, that it must effectively give up its support for the various militia groups in the Middle East. That is, to my mind, an extreme demand, and one which it's all but impossible for the Iranians ever to agree to. Over the last few hours, Iranian officials have actually been saying that for them, caps on their ballistic missiles is a red line. Their point being that if they agree to cap their ballistic missiles, to limit their range and to reduce their number, that makes them essentially defenseless. It eliminates, it does away with their deterrence capability against a country, Israel, that has been up to now consistently hostile to them. So I don't believe that the Iranians are ever going to agree to this. And I think that they will almost certainly fight rather than agree to it. But anyway, this is what Prime Minister Netanyahu supposedly came to the United States to demand from President Trump. Now, I think it's interesting to discuss who was present at this meeting between Trump and Netanyahu, which went on for nearly 3 hours, which is a very long meeting by any measure. So alongside Trump, the Americans who were present were Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. Jared Kushner's presence in these meetings, by the way, is a complete puzzle to me because, as far as I'm aware, Kushner actually holds no office in the United States government. He is merely the son-in-law of the president. But never mind, he's apparently able to attend these meetings. And the US ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who is, by the way, known to be an outspoken supporter of Israel in his various policies. Now, alongside Netanyahu, there was Israel's ambassador, Hekiel Leiter, its military secretary, Major General Roman Goffman, its acting director of the National Security Council, Jill Reich, Michael Eisenberg, Ziv Agmon, and an advisor, Ofir Falk. I don't know exactly the ranks of the last three people. But anyway, they were all there participating in this meeting. This looks like a huge meeting going on for 3 hours to discuss the whole range of the conflict with Iran. Netanyahu came with a very, very strong delegation. And the Americans came with a very strong delegation as well. And interestingly, to the extent that you can call them diplomats, the Americans had more diplomats, Rubio, Witkoff and Kushner, and of course their ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. Whereas the Israelis seem to have come more with military and security people, people from Israel's defense ministry and obviously also its National Security Council and people of that kind, including a military officer. Pete Hegseth, of course, the US Defense Secretary or War Secretary, was also present. So it's not as if there was nobody representing the American military who was also there. But anyway, they were all there. They were all talking about what to do with Iran. And then we had a very interesting statement on Truth Social from the President of the United States. I've just finished meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and various of his representatives. It was a very good meeting, the tremendous relationship between our two countries. There was nothing definitive reached other than I insisted that negotiations with Iran continue to see whether or not a deal can be consummated. If it can, I let the Prime Minister know that it will be a preference. If it cannot, we will just have to see what the outcome will be. Last time, Iran decided that they were better off not making a deal and they were hit with midnight hammer. That did not work well for them. Hopefully this time, they will be more reasonable and responsible. And then he says that they also discussed other things like Gaza, the region in general, and other matters. So what Trump here is telling us is that Netanyahu appears to have come pressing him to conduct some kind of attack on Iran. As I said, Netanyahu came with all of these military people with him. Trump, by contrast, had diplomats, or you can call them diplomats, with him instead, and pushed back and said no attack on Iran at the present time. I'm going to, my preference is negotiations. If the negotiations with Iran are unsuccessful, then we will have to look at the situation again. But for the moment, my preferred track is negotiations, and nothing definitive was agreed. Now, this is Trump basically telling us that there was a disagreement between himself and Netanyahu about what to do. Now, yesterday, I saw some reports, which I absolutely cannot confirm, that Netanyahu actually wanted to go to Congress and address Congress as well, which, based on what Trump is telling us, might have been a speech intended to rally congressional support for a war, for an attack on Iran. But according to the reports I saw yesterday, which, as I said, I cannot confirm, Trump said no. So it seems that we had a meeting. This is all based on what Trump is telling us. We had a meeting in which for 3 hours, Netanyahu tried to persuade Trump to order an attack on Iran. And Trump said no, and that he prefers to stick for the moment to the negotiating track. Now, why would Trump do that? After all, it is he who has deployed this enormous force, the already existing enormous force, to the Arabian Sea in preparation for what looked like an imminent attack on Iran. I can come up with no other explanation than that he has been told by his military officials that the US is not really ready for an attack at the present time, that Iran's defences are being strengthened, and perhaps that they're being strengthened with assistance from the Russians. That, it seems to me, is the only explanation for the apparent pause. Now, we have to be careful when discussing all of this, because before the attack on Iran in June, there were all sorts of reports circulating in the American media about how Donald Trump and Netanyahu were supposedly at odds, that Netanyahu was pressing for an attack on Iran and wasn't happy about the fact that Donald Trump was negotiating with Iran. And then an Israeli attack on Iran duly took place, and President Trump then announced that all of those earlier reports about disagreements between him and Prime Minister Netanyahu were a ruse intended to lull the Iranians into complacency whilst the decapitation strike against Iran by Israel was being carried out. Well, that was the story we were told then. And given that this was the story that we are to being told then, we can't be sure that we aren't seeing in Trump's latest Truth Social post exactly the same thing. Another attempt by President Trump to and Netanyahu, but especially Trump, to lull the Iranians into complacency, even as an attack is imminent. I am not sure. Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, said yesterday that the Iranians believe that the United States is now definitively pulling back from the idea of an attack against Iran. I'm not sure whether Larijani said this before reports about the deployment of the, or the possible deployment of a second American carrier and carrier group began to circulate. Perhaps he wasn't aware of that decision. I am not sure that any final decision not to attack Iran has been made in the United States. On the contrary, I think the indications certainly have been that previously a decision to attack Iran was definitely made. It could be that this has been dropped, that a reassessment of the military situation has led to a change. It is also known that the Arab states are very unhappy about a war with Iran at the present time. And it may also be that separately from whatever information the Americans have about what the Russians and the Chinese might be doing in Iran, they've also come to realize that an attack on Iran is not going to solve anything in the end, that the Iranian government will absorb the blow and will be able to take countermeasures of its own. These may include attacks on American bases, but more critically in some ways, even more critically in some ways, for the United States, it could also lead to the closure of the Gulf of Hormuz. So anyway, we shall see what the decisions are. But for the moment, it does look like there's a pause. And this is the closest that Trump himself has ever come to admitting, to saying publicly, that there is an argument, that there was an argument, a row between himself and Netanyahu. I am not saying that the Iranians should rely upon it, but anyway, it is interesting and it does call attention to the complex situation in the Middle East that we are now seeing. Anyway, we shall see. The Iranians are saying that there will indeed be further talks. Turkey is again being spoken of as a possible venue. I get the impression the Iranians still prefer Oman. We will see what comes of these talks. The first set of talks in Oman last week appear to have, as I said, shocked the Americans, with the Iranians sticking to their positions, to their red lines. We'll see whether the second talks go differently and whether the Americans are prepared to soften their demands, which, as I've said already, are pitched at a level to which the Iranians simply cannot agree. It may be that Netanyahu's visit to the United States, his constant urging to the Americans to conduct the attack on Iran, are because he does fear that the Americans might indeed, faced by what the Russians, the Chinese, and of course above all, and first and foremost, the Iranians are doing, he may be concerned, Netanyahu may be concerned, that the Americans are indeed preparing to soften their demands. If we do get an agreement, if there is an agreement between Iran and the United States, which will presumably be about Iran's nuclear enrichment capabilities, I think we can all breathe a sigh of relief, because another war in the Middle East is absolutely not something any of us should want. But I'm going to make a guess that that agreement will be perhaps a rather tighter version of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which it is universally accepted Iran mostly complied with. I say universally, the Israelis don't agree, and some people in the United States don't agree, but pretty much everyone else agrees that the Iranians complied with it, and which Donald Trump himself decided to walk out of. Anyway, that is the situation in the Middle East. The Chinese, incidentally, are taking a very great interest in the Iranian situation. And there are reports that one of the demands that the Americans are making to the Iranians is that Iran should stop supplying oil to China. And there are some suggestions that the second task force that the Americans are sending to the Arabian Sea is intended to assist the first task force to seize any tankers carrying Iranian oil that are steaming towards China. The Chinese are going to be extremely concerned and alarmed about this, and definitely they are taking countermeasures. Though, in terms of military countermeasures, I am not able to say exactly, obviously, what they are. I don't have the same levels of information from China that I do from Russia. One thing I would say, there's been an extraordinary admission in the United States that all of the F-35 fighter jets built in the United States over the course of 2025 were delivered to the US Air Force without radars. Instead, apparently, they included equipment used in gyms in order to create weight in the nose so that the balance of the aircrafts when they flew would remain stable. Now, that is absolutely extraordinary because, to my knowledge, the F-35, which is designed to engage in long-range air-to-air combat, heavily depends on its radars to conduct such combat. If it does not have a radar, an F-35 is essentially non-functional. Now, there's a lot of discussion on the internet as to why this situation has arisen. And it does seem that the latest batch of F-35s was supposed to use a new updated radar system and that there are delays in its production. Well, that's obvious. Obviously, there are delays in its production. I mean, that doesn't answer the question about why these delays exist. There is, of course, a great deal of speculation that one of the reasons, the critical reason for this, is the effect of the economic war between China and the United States last year. Over the course of it, at various point times, China restricted exports of rare earths and of other important products that are needed by the US military industrial complex. And one of them is apparently gallium, which, by the way, I understand as it happens, is not one of the rare earths. It is a mineral product, but it is not a rare earth, just saying. However, China produces 99% of the world's production. For the record, I believe that the second biggest producer, though far behind China, is Russia. Just saying. Anyway, apparently gallium is needed, is a component product necessary to produce these F-35 radars. And there are stories, there are claims, there are suspicions, none of which can be, of course, corroborated. and which in some places are heatedly denied, that the reason why there are the delays in producing these updated radars is because over the course of the economic war, the Chinese blocked exports to the United States of gallium, the necessary gallium to produce these radars. I, of course, do not know, but, and of course, it needs to also be said that when one is talking about advanced technological equipment, sometimes delays do arise, and it may be that this delay is entirely unconnected to the gallium shortage. But then, of course, I would have thought that the possibility that it is connected to the gallium shortage is real. Perhaps some of us would say that it is even plausible. In which case, consider the realities of what has happened over the last few years. The United States is now critically short of air defense missiles and is having problems ramping up production of air defense missiles and of replenishing its own stockpile of air defense missiles, because the Russians are draining the US of air defense missile capability through the aerial offensive that they are conducting in Ukraine. And the Chinese are obstructing US military production, specifically of F-35 fighter jets, by restricting or imposing restrictions on exports of critical minerals like gallium. I would add that as far as I've heard, gallium isn't just used for F-35s. It's used in Patriot missiles components and in THAAD missile components as well, and in all sorts of other categories of weapons, as of course rare earths are. Could it be that the reason for a further reason for the air defense missile shortage is not just that the Americans are shipping off whatever missile they do produce to the Europeans for onward resupply to Ukraine, but that they're having difficulties with production because of critical shortages of essential minerals, gallium and rare earths and other things, because of the conflict with China. I don't know, but I would absolutely not be surprised, of course, if this is a factor. Then I am also not surprised that the United States is unwilling to tell us about it. Probably it does not want the Chinese to know how effective their counteractions last year against the United States turned out to be. Though, of course, the Chinese, through their very extensive intelligence, will know all about it anyway. Anyway, that's what I want to say about the situation in the Middle East. Perhaps, just possibly, we have one or two more weeks of time for negotiations. And perhaps, if Ali Larijani is right, the Americans have assessed the situation and have decided that a war, which, by the way, would be fought for Israel's behalf, Iran is not a threat to the United States, that a war at this time between the United States and Iran is simply not viable or in America's interest. Anyway, let's move on to other things. We've had further furious statements from Zelensky in Ukraine, again saying that all these ideas that he was going to propose on the 24th of February, new elections in Ukraine and new referendums in Ukraine, that they are all news to him. He had no knowledge of them. He learned about them in the media, in the Financial Times, to be precise. He seems to be absolutely furious about this, and I suspect that he believes that the Americans try to bounce him into this, and he isn't taking it at all well. By the way, he continues to insist that there will be no withdrawal from Donbass. He's also said that as well. No withdrawal from Donbass, no withdrawal anywhere from anywhere else. The fighting must continue, and that the only acceptable solution, the only acceptable way to end the fighting is to have a ceasefire on the existing conflict line. Something which, of course, the Russians have rejected, and which Donald Trump also said he rejected, both at the Anchorage summit with Putin, though Trump then went back on it, and then in later comments after telephone calls that Trump had with Putin. So anyway, that is Zelensky. But yesterday in my programme, I said that another huge Russian missile strike against Ukraine was coming. And indeed it did. It was an enormous strike, again, involving 24 Iskander-M ballistic missiles launched, by the way, from the pre-2014 territory of Ukraine itself. And the targets clearly, again, were energy facilities. And immediately prior to this attack, on using the Iskander missiles, just a few hours before, the Russians also carried out a strike with a hypersonic Kinzhal missile on a major electricity substation located in western Ukraine, east of the city of Lvov. And I've discussed this electricity substation before. This substation apparently does not receive and then retransmit electric power supplied from Ukrainian power stations. Its purpose, its original purpose, as I understand, was to receive and then transmit electric power that first the Soviet Union and then Ukraine exported to various East European countries. But today, to receive electric power from the European Union, which at times of critical shortage is sent by the European Union to Ukraine from the European Union, and this electricity is received by this substation, which then transfers it to the various parts of the Ukrainian electricity system that use it. Now, this is very interesting, because what it means is that the Russians are indeed working to cut off Ukraine's entire electricity system, and ultimately, or so it seems to me, to cut off Ukraine completely from electric power. I say completely, of course, totality in this can never be completely achieved. There will always be generators and other things across Ukraine. There will always be someone somewhere in Ukraine who is producing electric power, but they will never be able to do it on the scale needed to maintain Ukraine's entire economic, industrial, and, by the way, administrative system to keep it functioning across the territory of Ukraine. For that, you need stable electric power produced by power stations, either within Ukraine itself or in the European Union, and supplying electricity to Ukraine. So it seems to me that the Russians are still testing and absorbing information about the Ukrainian electricity system, because a single strike with a single Kinzhal missile, which is what the Russians say the strike involved. The Ukrainians claimed that there were three Kinjal missiles and they shot down two. I don't believe they shot any Kinjal missiles down close to this power station. I believe that there was only one used, and that was the one that hit the station. Anyway, that's another story. I'm not going to get into the details of that. One Kinjal missile, I would have thought, is unlikely to destroy completely a very significant, a very expansive facility like an electricity power station of the size that this one apparently is. But to repeat again, and I've discussed this in previous programs, an Oreshnik absolutely can. An Oreshnik launched from Kapustin Yar absolutely has the range to reach this electricity power station. And as an area weapon, it's 36 warheads crashing into the power station at hypersonic speeds and probably causing a significant earth tremor would surely do tremendous destruction to a facility of this kind and probably destroy it utterly. And given that the Russians are taking an interest in this substation, and by the way, another substation located to the west of Kiev, which connects Kiev to the nuclear power plants, I strongly suspect that such Oreshnik strikes against these two substations must be coming. Since the Russians are attacking these substations, presumably their intention is eventually to knock them out. And in order to knock them out, they would use the very weapon that they have developed precisely for the purpose of knocking such facilities out, which is, of course, the Oreshnik. So I'm guessing that this is coming. The fact that the Russians use the Kinjal suggests that perhaps deployment and production of Oreshniks in Russia is still at a relatively early stage. And probably the Russians anyway were looking to conduct disruption of the work of this substation to see what needs to be done to destroy it properly and to see what the actual effect of destroying this substation is going to be. In the meantime, the other missiles, apparently 24 Iskander missiles, crashed into various power stations across Ukraine. And again, I get the sense that most of Ukraine's big cities, Kiev, Dnipro, Odessa, Kharkiv, were all targeted. Probably other big cities too. And in the case of Kiev, it looks as if the last remaining thermal power plant was specifically attacked and was perhaps destroyed. The mayor of Kiev, Vitaly Klitschko, is again saying that the situation is desperate. The situation in Ukraine is critical, that many of the great apartment buildings are once again without power, and the situation in Kiev with power is extremely bad. As for the damage done elsewhere in Ukraine, there's still information pouring in, and I will have to return to that topic in a future program. Again, I didn't see much sign in the few pictures of this strike that I have seen of Ukrainian air defences operating. And by the way, interestingly, alongside the ballistic missiles, the Russians also appear to have launched, this is according to the Ukrainians, a single Kh-69 stealth subsonic cruise missile This presumably was launched by a Sukhoi 57 fifth generation fighter. This is Russia's stealth fighter jet. There has been many, many claims. You can find them all over the internet that this particular fighter jet does not have a true stealth capability. It's often derided and mocked as not being a true fifth generation fighter jet at all. Well, I'm not an expert in these things. What I would say is that Rostec, the giant corporation that operates Russia's military industrial complex, says that over the last couple of days, the Russian Air Force received a big batch of updated Sukhoi 57 fighters. Updated, nobody knows in quite what way, perhaps with more advanced radars. It seems that for the moment, the engine, the aircraft engine, is the same, that there are at least two new aircraft engines designed for the Sukhoi 57, which are under test in Russia. Just saying. And anyway, the Rostec says that more of these fighters have been supplied to the Russian Air Force. And the Russian Defense Minister, Andrei Belousov, recently said that the Sukhoi 57 regularly operates over Ukrainian airspace, even in places where other Russian fighters don't go because of the density of Ukraine's air defenses. And because they are stealthy, Ukraine's air defenses can't track or attack them. So anyway, that's what the Russians say. You can decide for yourself who in this case you choose to believe. So this is an enormous big strike by the Russians on Ukraine, another devastating strike. The Ukrainians did try a strike of their own. Again, it seemed to be aimed towards Volgograd and Tambov regions deep inside Russia. But as I've discussed many times, these strikes don't seem to me to be especially effective, and it doesn't seem as if a huge amount of damage was actually done. And that, I suspect, remains the case, and I don't really expect that to change. Well, the Russians, over and above whatever it may be that they're doing in relation to Ukraine, have been busy on other things. It's been pointed out to me over the last couple of days that a mysterious Russian radar station that has existed since the 1960s, and which I remember I used to listen to every so often when it broadcast in earlier years when I did used to do shortwave radio listening. Anyway, that this Russian radio station, which nobody can quite understand what it does, anyway, it's been incredibly active churning out messages over the last couple of days, apparently on an almost unprecedented scale. The theory is that this radar station is used by the Russians to communicate with their various agents who are operating presumably mostly in the West. There's some speculation that the activity of this radar station is connected to the situation in the Middle East, Iran specifically. That may, of course, be true. But for the record, I think that it is still connected to the Ukraine conflict and is consistent with the steps the Russians are taking to prepare for their big offensive, their big knockout offensive, which I believe is coming in the spring. Now, as to that, I noticed that the Russian Defense Minister, Belousov, has again been busy. He's gone and has visited one of the group of forces. I believe from memory that it was Group of Forces South. This is the force that, as far as I'm aware, has been mostly involved repelling the Ukrainian attacks, counterattacks in Zaporozhye region. Now, there's been a lot of claims and counterclaims about this counterattack. Yesterday, the Ukrainians made all sorts of claims about large areas of territory that they have supposedly recaptured. Many people have pointed out that this territory is actually was actually in the so-called grey zone, which means it was contested rather than being under Russian control. Anyway, I'm not going to get into a discussion about the success of this counteroffensive or otherwise. I would make just two observations. Firstly, there's again a critical shortage of drone footage to confirm these Ukrainian claims. And secondly, Radovka, the Russian newspaper based in Smolensk, which I have consistently felt has been one of the most reliable reporters of the state of the actual fighting on the front lines in Ukraine. Anyway, Radovka is saying that the Ukrainian counterattacks have been a complete debacle. So anyway, that is what they're reporting, and I suspect they're probably telling the truth. But anyway, elsewhere, fighting does go on. Even neutral mappers now seem to be coming close to acknowledging that the Russians are on the brink of capturing the village of Grishino, north of Pokrovsk, very heavily fortified position that the Ukrainians have, and one that stood in the way of further Russian advances north. And of course, we've had further reports of further Russian advances in the Kupiansk and Slavyansk areas, which I'm going to not discuss. I'm not going to discuss in any detail on this program. What I do want to turn attention to is an absolutely bizarre article, one of the strangest articles in the Ukraine war published up to now that I have seen. And this is an article that came out 2 days ago in the New York Times. And its title is Russia Nears Capture of Key Ukrainian Towns After Year of Grinding Assaults. Russian troops have advanced at a glacial pace in recent months, but gains in southern and eastern Ukraine could give Moscow an edge in mediated peace talks. And then we're told that for over a year, Russian forces have slogged through battlefields in Ukraine without seizing a single urban stronghold. That, by the way, is completely untrue. That is absolutely not true. As I said, it ignores the captures, the capture of Torezhsk, Chasiv-Yar, and Siversk. The capture of Siversk, admitted by the Ukrainians themselves. But anyway, let's not dwell too much on that. And Velikaya Novosilka as well, by the way. And then it goes on to say, now these attritional advances are on the verge of paying off. Russia appears poised to complete the capture of three strategic areas in the coming weeks or months, according to military experts and independent battlefield monitors. Capturing all three areas, the town of Guliapolye in the southeast and the cities of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, about 60 miles northeast, would give Russia an urban foothold to base troops and organize logistics for future offensives, as well as new leverage in US-mediated peace talks. I have to say, I find this article not only extraordinary, but at a fundamental level, totally absurd. Gulyapolye's capture by the Russians is disputed by no one. Even lots of Ukrainian commentators and certainly all the various bloggers have spoken about it. To pretend that any part of Gulyapolye is still under Ukrainian control is grotesque. For the record, just a few days ago, I read an article in the Financial Times which had a map, which I believe originates with the Institute of the Study of War, which still shows Gulyapolye under Ukrainian control. I said that was about 3 days ago. To repeat again, Gulyapolye is under Russian control, and nobody, no serious objective observer of the conflict seriously denies it. As for Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, there is no doubt whatsoever that they were captured about, I think it was about 2 months ago, maybe less, by the Russians. The Russians are fighting north, well north of both of these towns. In Rodinsk, well, Rodinsk has also been captured, but in Belitska, in Gryshino, in all of these places. In fact, as I said, it looks as if Gryshino is about to fall. No one seriously disputes, no one who seriously monitors and observes the war with any trace of objectivity seriously disputes that the Russians have captured both of these towns. Now, this brings me to two specific points. Firstly, when you read articles like this in the New York Times, and by the way, they're far from untypical, then of course that does cast further doubt on the accuracy of much of the information that is being published in the media in the West about the course of the conflict in Ukraine. And, well, if they could be as wrong as something as straightforward as this, as who controls towns the size of Gulyapolye and Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, then we should be particularly careful before jumping to conclusions and accepting their views and claims about the level of Russian casualties. That is one. The second, which follows from the first, is that when you read various claims about how the Russians have advanced and captured 1.5% of Ukrainian territory since 2024, and things of that kind, well, do bear in mind that the people who are telling you this are probably working from the wrong maps and don't understand how much territory the Russians have in fact captured. Just saying. Anyway, it is interesting that the New York Times does nonetheless acknowledge that the capture of these three places does resolve further Russian logistical problems, does provide the Russians with a secure base area that they can use for further offensives in the future. Now, in my recent programs, I have been discussing the various comments that have been made by Sergei Lavrov over the last couple of days, last week or so. I should say that I have never known such an extensive and powerful series of interviews and commentaries by Lavrov in all the time that I have been keeping track of what he has been saying. And that extends back, well, for 5, 6, 7 years now. So, I mean, he spoke first, he gave an interview, as I remember, he gave a whole series of interviews. He started with an interview on Russian television, then he gave a further interview to another part of Russian television. Then he gave an interview to BRICS television. Then he gave a long interview to a blogger who, or some media outlet that I admit I've not heard of, though I should say it was an extremely strong interview. Then he gave a speech, an address to the Duma about the situation in foreign policy. The foreign policy situation. And then he actually took questions from some of the parliamentarians. And he was repeating the same points in one interview, one commentary, one speech, one address after the other, day after day after day, that the Americans made promises in Anchorage that they haven't kept. He has revealed in one of these interviews that before the Anchorage summit meeting, the Russians were given by Witkoff a document, apparently approved by Trump himself, in which the American proposals, the ones that the Russians accepted in Anchorage, were set out. So there's actually a document that sets out what the American proposal, in fact, was. And the Russians are in possession of it. Anyway, he says that the Americans have backtracked on all of that. He says that there's been absolutely no movement on anything, on lifting or relaxing sanctions, on restoring air links, on returning diplomatic property. Instead, there've been more sanctions, the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. Perhaps things haven't got even worse than they might have done. We haven't had Tomahawk missile deliveries to Ukraine, but in all other respects, it's all been talk, and the action is going in the wrong direction. And a specific point that seems to particularly infuriate Lavrov is that the Americans have been discussing security guarantees with the Europeans and with the Ukrainians. And they've not kept the Russians informed about those. And as Lavrov said, they have not even condescended, the Americans have not condescended, to provide to the Russians whatever document setting out these security guarantees that the Americans, have negotiated with the Ukrainians. The way Lavrov put it is that the only information the Russians have about this document, about this question of security guarantees, comes from the media. When Kushner and Witkoff came to Moscow on the 23rd of January and met with Putin in the Kremlin, Ushakov, Putin's aide, gave a briefing in which he said that the discussion had been frank. I think now we could see why it was frank. Frank, as I said, is often a word that implies in Russian briefings a heated discussion. Larry Johnson said it looked like the discussion was heated. At the time, I didn't agree. I've now come round to Larry Johnson's view. It seems to me that that the discussion was heated, that Putin was clearly angered by the fact that in all of the papers that the Americans brought with them, they didn't bring with them this critical document, the security guarantee document, this document is being withheld from the Russians. And that is undermining the negotiations. It is undermining the talks. Now, the Russians are taking action. They are launching strikes across Ukraine. They're taking steps to cut Ukraine off from electricity. And we've had a whole succession of statements from Lavrov that are clearly a warning, not just to the Russian people, but to the Americans as well, that the negotiations are going nowhere and that the Russians are close to giving up. Giving up, not with the negotiations. They're not saying that they won't still send their people to meet with the Ukrainians and the Americans. But bear in mind, the negotiations currently are taking place from the Russian side at a very low level. Back in December, Putin said that when serious negotiations begin, they will be led by the Russian Foreign Ministry, by Lavrov and his officials. In other words, Lavrov gives me the impression of being very angry. I have come fully to the view that he's acting with Putin's full agreement and on Putin's instructions. And my own view is that the Russians have ceased to have any expectations that these negotiations are going to go anywhere at all, and that they're overwhelmingly focused now on winning the war in Ukraine, and that that is going to be their priority. So I just wanted to set it all out in one further place, all together, summarising all of the various things that Lavrov has said. Now, I'm going to finish this programme by touching on two quick points. Firstly, I was absolutely appalled by the presentation of the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, to the United States Congress, the congressional testimony she gave over the Epstein scandal. It seemed to me that Bondi was extraordinarily evasive and at times aggressive, where she absolutely didn't need to be, and where the situation absolutely does not call for it. Now, I've made this point in various programs, but I'm going to make it again. What documentation the Justice Department has about Epstein's various activities is only going to be the documentation that Epstein himself preserved. It is not a full record of his many and various activities, not remotely. In fact, some of the most incriminating and probably terrible things that were done, I strongly suspect that Epstein never made any record of them at all. But though I have only skimmed through some of the document dump and only looked at some of the things that have been revealed, it seems to me that the document dump is littered with leads which a tough-minded investigator could use as a basis for further investigation. There are lots of things that took place that seem to me to be deeply suspicious, to say the least, and given the whole totality of the circumstances, I have to say that the suggestion that there is no evidence of criminal behaviour here, well, to me that sounds absolutely bizarre to the point of being extraordinary. Now, to repeat again, I've never been an investigator myself, but I've been able to review investigations. I know something of what I speak. I find the explanations Pam Bondi gave completely incredible. Anyway, I would also say that as far as I am concerned, her performance is almost calculated to make the scandal even bigger than it already is. And it was already big enough. I am confident that an awful lot more revelations are going to come out, certainly in the United States, and eventually, by the way, also in Britain, and no doubt in other places too. I'm not going to anticipate what they are. I don't know what they are, but I am sure that they're coming. Now, the other thing, the last thing, the very last thing I'm going to discuss is an article that has been written on Naked Capitalism by Eve Smith, in which she discusses the possible effect on the oil price if the Iranians did indeed close the Strait of Hormuz, or if they didn't close the Strait of Hormuz fully, but took steps which might reduce or limit traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. Now, apparently there's a report in Bloomberg which says that oil prices would in that case only increase up to $108 a barrel, assuming that the Iranians didn't go all the way. I have absolutely no doubt that in an all-out conflict, the Iranians would go all the way. They've said so, given that this is now increasingly looking like an existential conflict for them. I don't see why they would not decide to go all the way. I would have thought that the last thing they would be worried about at that point is their own oil exports. At that point, their priority would be to win the war and, or rather, to survive the long conflict that they are themselves talking about. They're taking steps to get protection from their BRICS partners. If their BRICS partners are indeed providing them with military assistance, which I believe they are, then it is reasonable to assume that they're also going to provide Iran with the necessary economic aid to get Iran through a long war, absent any Iranian oil exports. Just saying. So I think the Iranians would close the Straits of Hormuz. As for China, I think it would be looking to buy more oil from Russia. Russia would be able to fulfill Chinese needs for oil if the Straits of Hormuz were to close. There would be technical problems. Some Russian oil is heavier than the light Arabian crude that China imports from Iran and Saudi Arabia. I'm confident that the Chinese, with their refineries, would be able to take steps to mitigate that problem. And obviously, there's also issues with transport. Most of the facilities for exporting oil from Russia are located in the Baltic, as it happens, and the Black Sea. But the Russians do have oil export facilities in the Arctic, where there would be no impediment for tankers to sail directly to China. I believe that in a crisis, the Russians and the Chinese would quickly find ways round. Again, I think people underestimate the speed with which these two countries would be able to work on something like this in the event of a crisis. My key point is, however, that $108 a barrel would be a catastrophic blow at this time for the British and European economies. Personally, I think it is highly likely that the price of oil would go much higher. I think that the United States, which is an oil producer and exporter, could withstand the blow. I think many other countries around the world would be in very serious trouble. I can't even begin to think what this would do to India, for example. But the Chinese and the Russians would get by, and the Europeans, the British, would be in a terrible place. We've just had more economic news from Britain. Basically, in the last quarter of 2025, growth in Britain, in the British economy, stopped. We have an effectively stagnant economy in Britain, on top of all our other many problems. An oil price that rises from, what is it, between $60 and $70. Well, sometimes it's been less than 60, it's been closer to $50 a barrel, all the way up to $108 a barrel, would be a disaster. Even an increase of $20 a barrel, which I believe another report that Eve Smith alludes to, says is what might happen. Even if it was only that small an increase in Britain and Europe, I am confident that it would be an almost unbearable blow for us. Anyway, this is a topic we will no doubt discuss in future programmes, both here and on the Duran. Let's hope that a war in the Gulf is avoided and we avoid these calamities. But in the meantime, let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Don't forget also to check out our Substack blog. In the meantime, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.